Hi everyone. Welcome to a virtual salon at the Stowe Center or virtual Stowe Center. My name is Amy Huffnagel and I'm the Director of Programs and Visitor Experience at the Stowe Center. And I am thrilled to be with you all here in this space and can't wait also to return to in-person programming in the near future. This program is produced by the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in collaboration with the American Academy of Arts and Science and their Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship. This is the third program in a series. They're being recorded so that they become podcasts on our multimedia website. And so I want to encourage you all to check out that multimedia website if you haven't already for some great listening programs as well as watching programs. All of these programs, but this one in particular, are intended to create a cultural space for direct, open-ended, and inclusive conversations about complex and always evolving American history, with a specific interest in looking at a common purpose report and themes of how we teach history in the United States. These salons were sort of conceived of by me with this idea of how do you create an environment where you're encouraging constructive dialogue between people, and then again, how the common purpose position is saying about how do you strengthen democracy at this moment. But we'll get into all of that. So let me introduce our speakers and what to just tell you a little bit in housekeeping what's going to happen. We're going to have a sort of framing of why we're all here in the sort of big concepts of the work of a more democratic society, and then have our speakers be in conversation with each other. So we'll pin them front and center, and then we will open conversations with all of you who have chosen to be with us this evening. So first, let me introduce Abhishek Raman, who is the Program Officer of the American Institutions, Society, and the Public Good at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In his role there, he is responsible for developing and implementing a strategy to advance our common purpose recommendations, focusing on civic media, civic infrastructure, and civic culture that support this idea of a healthy democracy. Abhishek, thank you so much for being here. And I would like to just have you speak at this point, and then we'll introduce our other speakers.
Thank you, Amy. And thank you to the Stowe Center for hosting this event and this important conversation tonight. So the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, where I come from, was founded in 1780 by John Adams and other Patriot scholars to be a resource for a new nation. The Academy is in part a membership organization that grants admission to leaders in academia, business, politics, and the arts. The Academy is also an independent, nonpartisan policy center dedicated to addressing the most pressing questions facing the US and the world. It brings together the best minds from both inside and outside of membership to develop practical, thoughtful solutions and to effect positive change. It is in that spirit that the Academy launched the Bipartisan Commission on the Practice of Democratic Citizenship in 2018 in response to the mounting crisis facing American democracy. The commission recognized the deep problems that confront us, not just in the function of our political institutions, but also in our civic culture, that is in Americans' ability to find common ground. As part of its work, the commission held over 50 listening sessions across the country. The commissioners heard from Americans across demographic, regional, and political divides. They heard amazing stories about the work being done to bridge divides and create stronger communities. But at the same time, they also heard frustrations and fears about the future of our democracy. Fears that Americans are unable to come together across difference, that there is more dividing them than uniting them. The Commission's report, Our Common Purpose, that was released in May 2020, offers a unique theory of change. It puts forth the idea that the nation is trapped in a vicious cycle, that unrepresentative institutions lead to political disengagement, which further leads to less representative leadership and institutions. So our Common Purpose report is rooted in the premise that change cannot only be focused in one area. It offers 31 recommendations targeted at political institutions, our political culture, and our civil society. It does not matter if we have the best designed political institutions in the world, but if voters are unable to compromise and unable to see themselves as part of a shared common good with people that they disagree with politically, we cannot build a strong constitutional democracy. So we need to make progress in all these three areas to truly reinvent and repair American democracy. One of the 31 recommendations focuses on telling our nation's story. The recommendation calls on Americans to develop a new shared narrative that acknowledges both the glory and the gory of our history. This recommendation asks individuals and organizations to engage in direct, open-ended, and honest conversations about our past faults and failures. One thing the commission heard in their listening sessions was that Americans had a sense that our partisan divides affect how we think about the past, and that these historical debates further divide us. The recommendation calls for conversations like this one that we're having tonight to think about how narratives of the past can help us to build a better future. So telling our nation's story is a really crucial recommendation for building a healthier civil society, which will help us restore a more resilient civic culture and more responsive political institutions. And we at the Academy are very excited to partner with the Stowe Center to engage in the work of historical examination, which is a central part of the project of repairing our constitutional democracy.
So that's just beautiful. Thank you so much for that context. And I want to encourage all of our participants to take the time to visit and maybe add into the chat the link to Our Common Purpose and the paper and the way in which it summarizes the research that was done over those 2 years. I find it remarkably enlightening. Okay, moving on. Thank you so much. At this point, we're going to move into conversation with Dr. Anna Malika Tubbs, and she is joined by Janae Woods Weber. Now, Anna is joining us from California, where she is a writer and scholar. I want you to go into her website and Google her so that you can see all of her amazing accomplishments and work, but described as a multidisciplinary expert on current and historical understandings of race, gender, and equity. She graduated from Stanford, has a BA in anthropology, and then went on to gender studies and PhD in sociology at Cambridge as a Bill and Melinda Gates Cambridge Scholar. And Jenny is a longtime activist and advocate and joins us from Hartford or West Hartford, right in our neighborhood, a facilitator and trainer on social justice issues, and currently working as the executive director of Connecticut's Women's Education and Legal Fund, and previously served as a program director at Everyday Democracy, which is deeply working with the team on the Common Purpose Projects too, her past organization, and really has worked on so many important issues, including food security, community prosperity, immigration, education, and of course, undoing racism. Women, it's a pleasure to have you here with us tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Amy.
Thank you, it's such a delight. And thank you and welcome to everyone who's joining us tonight. I'm excited to see everyone here. I'm looking forward to a really robust conversation.
I made myself little, but I am gonna start with a question myself. I think both of your work focuses on thinking and acting to raise up women, to strengthen and the role that women play in strengthening the social justice and equity, legal education opportunities in our communities and in our country. I know you both will speak about the importance of storytelling, role models, and direct action in unique ways. But before we talk about the women who have paved the way historically and the work that you're doing now around that, I want to start by asking you both to just personally talk about the fact that I find we're living in this sort of ocean of violence and a sea of attacks on civil liberties and the rights of women around the world and the globe. You know, how do you start your days? How do you address gender and social change and keep what I love to always refer to as James Baldwin's words, keep the blues-soaked hope alive every day?
Danae, do you want to start?
Sure. How do I keep hope alive? That's the big question. Ooh, well, I believe that the recommitment to hope is a daily process. I often think back to a talk I saw by the Latina transgender activist, Isa Noyola, and she said that hope is for people who have time to wait. And I think about that a lot, sometimes daily, and it reminds me to really focus on the urgency of right now. I don't need to wait. I can do what I can within my own power to live a full life and to participate in creating change. And the thing that motivates me toward that is this deep understanding I have that I am not here by accident. And I'm not talking about fate. What I mean is that my ancestors fought for my life. They fought for me to be here. I am here because of the work of those who came before me. They were hopeful, so hopeful that they became mothers, they had children, they carried on. And I find great hope in that and great promise.
That's beautiful. I'd say for me, I focus a lot on the journey because we so often are focused on not being where we should be already, which I do believe is the case. If we're speaking about our nation, I do believe that there's so much left to be done. But because I study so much of American history, and very specifically with my book, Three Women and Three Black Women, Three Black Mothers in American History, I have to remind myself that we have come a very far way because of the works that they were committed to and what they did in their lives to make this world better for me several years later. And we're part of this process. It's not one person and it's not connected to one thing, but it's a larger movement, a larger team of people. And that's what brings me a lot of hope, this continuance of not only the issues we're facing, but the continuance of the resistance against that, the fight against that, the many different strategies that we're using to tackle all of the issues that try to dehumanize us, try to put us in boxes, try to take away the dignity and the respect that we all deserve. I find a lot of hope in studying those who came before us. So similar to Janae in that sense. Mm.
I love that you touched upon this notion of there's a continuity to this work and there's a constant moving forward as we continue to grow and build this democracy. And one of the things that I was really thinking about as I dove into reading The Three Mothers was the backdrop for your research and writing of this beautiful, extraordinary book. Thank you. I couldn't help but wonder what you were experiencing emotionally and intellectually while you were researching the stories of these three women who birthed men who would grow up to become civil rights icons, whom we now know were heroes in their own right. And you're researching this and writing this book against the backdrop of a racist, misogynistic man who's ascending to power in the Oval Office during a time of increasing xenophobia, during a time of growing public consciousness, of police brutality against Black and Brown people. How did that inform your analysis and the tone that you took when you wrote your book?
I appreciate that question so much. For me, a important goal of this book was that from the beginning, everybody knew, although we're talking about three women in history, that this isn't ancient history, and that everything we're going to learn about each of them, Alberta King, Burtis Baldwin, Louise Little, is so that we know how we arrived as a nation where we are right now, and so that we can apply their lessons to the issues that we're still facing. That from the beginning, I was gonna say that I am personally involved in this kind of pain and the fear that comes with being a Black woman, but also in celebrating that resistance and the revolutionary power of Black maternal love, that we were going to talk about what we were seeing in our country, in our headlines right now. And even to go back to that point that it wasn't ancient history, that Burtis Baldwin lives until 1999 and Louise Little doesn't pass away until 1991. And Alberta might have also lived that long had she not herself been shot in 1974. And so making sure that there was that direct connection throughout my writing was very important. But of course, in terms of feeling and emotions, it was a difficult book to write. This was really painful. It was painful for me to make the decision to say, I'm going to start the book with George Floyd's final words before he's killed. But I wanted to make sure that everyone knew from the very first pages, this is relevant to right now. You're not just going to read this book and say, let's admire the strength of Black women that we so often come to. And that's all Black women hear is, wow, you're so strong. We admire you for that. But instead, let's say, how do we translate that admiration into action? Because we're still experiencing so much of what Alberta, Burtis, and Louise were fighting against. So we need to take this a step further. We need to think at every stage, every decade that I'm speaking about, how does that apply to where we are in our current moment?
Where we are in our current moment is that Black women politically are some of the strongest voting blocks for particular candidates.
Yeah.
And yet we see this continued practice of Black women's labor being exploited or unrecognized, while at the same time, Black women are being held up as the moral compass of our democracy.
Mm-hmm.
How do we shift that narrative so that it becomes more full and so that we ourselves, particularly Black mothers, are building political power? I love what you said before about Black motherhood being revolutionary. Mm-hmm. How do we center the people who are most impacted, who are often Black mothers, how do we center them in this work of building our democracy and being a truly multiracial, inclusive democracy where everyone can thrive?
I love that question. For me, it takes me back to why I wanted to study Black mothers to begin with. Black mothers are the only ones who legally in our country, in our history, have been deemed the givers of non-life. So when they gave birth, it wasn't the giver of a child, of life, it was the giver of somebody else's property. So this dehumanization of Black women and Black children. So for anybody who didn't believe that dehumanization exists, and when we as Black people today say we're being dehumanized, this is real. Let's come back to an example that you cannot debate with. It was written in law, you are not human and your children are not human. But Black mothers have never seen themselves as if they're somebody else's property. They've always seen themselves as the human beings who they are. They've seen their children as those human beings who deserve respect, who deserve dignity, just like anybody else does. And so by that nature, Black women have had this vision of what's possible in our country and in our world that extended beyond what was readily available to us. So we're these visionaries who are revolutionary in our thinking as a part of our survival. We cannot accept the circumstance as it currently is right now, because that circumstance doesn't align with how we see ourselves and we see our descendants. So every time if we go back through US history and we see the ways in which Black women have forced the country to see things through their eyes, have pushed the country forward, have said, you know, when we have these moments where someone might say, we're not ready for that, Black women have never, we're not going to sit here and say, until you're ready, then we'll come with this vision, because it has to do with our survival. So even when Vice President Kamala Harris was running for her presidency, so many people said, the country is not ready for that. the country has never been ready for a Black woman's vision of what's possible. But that's even more the reason why we need to elect Black women more and more. Of course, you know, we now have this very exciting promise from President Biden that we're going to have our first Black female Supreme Court justice. So this is what we're looking for. We need to back Black women if we admire them so. And it's this kind of unspoken truth that Black women have. You know, I don't like to say that Black women have more strength than anybody else, because I think that's also a form of dehumanization. But I do believe Black women, through their experience of being dehumanized in this country while still creating life, not only through children, but through their activism, through their art, through their creativity, they have a plan that's very unique, that encompasses humanity for more of us, if not all of us. So we have to hear that more often. We have to put Black women in these leadership positions. But that doesn't mean that we then just hoist all of this pressure on their shoulders, because we've been doing that for years. It means we're actually going to listen. We're going to follow. We're going to give power where it should be held. And we're also going to support. We're going to do our part in that. We're going to make sure that we vote in ways that make it possible even for more Black women to be elected. So I think if there's only one answer that you take from that, elect more Black women into positions of power.
Well, I will co-sign that. And you said something about Black women having the vision, grounded in this love, grounded in this understanding of who we could be. And I think that is a theme that is so incredibly highlighted throughout this book about the three mothers. They were not themselves in positions of political power. They were not office holders. However, they were using their wisdom, their experiences, their hope, behind the scenes, you know, let's say, as they were raising their sons, as they were raising Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and James Baldwin. So many of the lessons that we revere them for now, so many of the lessons that we say help shift the course of the United States to become who we are today, those were lessons that they learned from their mothers. Mm-hmm. And I would love for us to have like a deeper conversation about what it means to really listen to mothers, to center the experiences, particularly of mothers of color, when we think about policy shifts, when we think about cultural shifts. Because I saw a quote from your mother that you shared, where she said, when a mother is doing well, the community is doing well.
Yeah.
Do you think we've moved away from some of that thinking around how motherhood can really help shape leaders that was so evident and prominent in this book?
I'm not sure that was ever something that nationally has been respected or believed, to be honest. So I don't think we've necessarily moved away from anything. I think it's been consistent in terms of even patriarchal laws that have written that have made it so that men had more power over women. And this expression of motherhood is almost this ultimate form of the feminine and the thing that men want to dominate. So this is more from my gender studies kind of mentality of the theory around why this has come to be the case. But it's very strategic to put motherhood in this kind of box and say that it only fits in the domestic, and all of the female qualities that come with motherhood are the weaker ones and the things that should be dominated. And there's a lot of theory around why that might be the case, that the actual weaker person wants to dominate the powerful one because they're afraid. If anyone wants to read a book about this, Of Woman Born is an essential kind of place to start in thinking about the fact that a lot of men are fearful of the need that we have for women to birth more children, to keep communities going, even from this biological perspective. And that has maybe caused so much of this need to control through violence, through coercion, through so many other things. So I would say that what we do need to do is move towards the perspective of one that my mom had and always taught me. She was a lawyer. We had the privilege of traveling with her from country to country where she advocated for women's rights, not only in the US, but also abroad. And she'd always say to me, pay attention to how women are being treated, and very specifically how the role of motherhood is being treated in the city or in this community. And that will be an indicator for how this community is doing in every other way, whether that's through money that they're able to make or all of the different things. Do they have a strong economy? Do they have a strong sense of unity? Do they have a strong, all of these other things that she said always started with motherhood. So it's something I always had in the back of my mind and paid very close attention to when I was starting this project. And I knew that that was going to be the case. The surprises that came up for me in doing this research were how shocking, how clear it was that these sons learned what they learned from their mothers, that it wasn't even my intention to say MLK Jr. did this because Alberta King did this. My intention was to say, let's speak about this woman in her own right, because it's going to be an interesting story to tell. It'll reveal to us, you know, pieces of the puzzle that are missing. But the shock, even though it really shouldn't be so shocking, is that it is so intentional to have erased this mother, because we really did not know these sons without these mothers' stories. The connections are undeniable. So just to give a little background for those that haven't read the book yet, with Alberta King, she's raised to believe that Christian faith is always intertwined with social justice, that if you have access to an education, you use that as a tool to advance freedom causes forward for your entire community. She doesn't call it nonviolence, so maybe just the terminology is different, but she participates in marches and in boycotts, and she believes that grassroots organizing is the way that you can accomplish change. So this is Alberta King long before her children are even a thought in her mind. If we think about Malcolm X and his mother, Louise Little, and, you know, we mentioned a little bit that sometimes they're leading from the background. I would say Louise Little is the complete opposite of that. She is front and center in a fight for Black independence and Black pride. She's this radical activist who is part of the Marcus Garvey movement. She writes for the Negro World newspaper. She even stands up physically to the KKK. She is someone who is unapologetic about standing for Black self-sufficiency and anti-white assimilation. So all the things that those of us who revere Malcolm X revere him for, he learns directly from his mother, his father as well, but we've told that story. We've been missing the mother all along. And then thirdly, with Burtis Baldwin, James Baldwin's mother, she believes that she can help people find healing and find the light and confront hatred and confront pain through her writing. She has a brilliant mind and she uses her words to help people come to a realization of the world that they might not have seen on their own. So when her son later, famous James Baldwin, at one point says that he's a witness to the power of light, he's not just saying something beautiful, he's directly quoting his mother and her work.
Mm. Power of these Black women is undeniable. And I love that you talked about Louise Little being this formidable presence in the freedom movement herself, because to me, she represents a Black woman for whom her Blackness is inextricably intertwined with her womanhood.
Right.
And I think about that, and then I think about, well, what does it take for women en masse to topple the patriarchy, to topple white supremacy? And it would require white women to choose their womanhood over their whiteness. And I wonder how we start to bridge that divide, because for Black women, our Blackness is so tied up in our womanhood, because we are often first seen by the color of our skin and not by our gender. And we're not given a choice in the ways that white women can abandon their womanhood in order to claim whiteness and the privileges that come along with that. Mm-hmm. So I really feel like this is this struggle that we're having amongst women as we really try to think about what does it mean to build a woman-centered democracy? What does it mean to build a democracy that values all women, that values mothers? There's this struggle that we are having with one another across race and gender.
I agree. And I'd love to hear how that shows up in your work as well, and how you tackle this need for us to think more through the intersectionality of our identities, and how some of us have a privileged that others don't and a choice that others don't?
That's a big question that we are grappling with right now at Connecticut Women's Education Legal Fund, which I have the great fortune of being the new executive director for. We're 48 years old, and for the first 48 years of our existence, we were a white-led organization with primarily white women supporters working on what some people might consider to be white feminist issues. As we think about who do we want to be, what kind of organization must we become in order to meet the needs of women in this moment, we are thinking really critically about who are we centering in this moment. We really need to be centering the women who have been purposely and intentionally disempowered, disenfranchised, and under-resourced and pushed to the margins. We need to bring them to the center. And nationally, and of course here in Connecticut, that means paying particular attention to the needs of Black and Brown women, trans women, Native and Indigenous women, and women who are survivors of violence, and really putting them at the center of our work. And in doing so, we've also been thinking about, well, how do we continue to be in relationship with the white women who have helped build up this organization, who have shown up to do the work, to help advocate for the policies that we now have won here in Connecticut that are making Connecticut a much better place for women and girls to thrive? How are we bringing them along? And for us, we're really thinking about how do we widen this circle so that white women still are in the circle, but perhaps not at the center. At this moment, at the center are the people who are most impacted. And we're doing a lot of introspection and just interrogation of ourselves as an organization around how are we really thinking about how we address how white supremacy shows up, you know, in the way that we engage and interact with community. How does it show up in how we think about who's most impacted by policy? How do we make sure that we are bringing the community most impacted closer into the conversations and the decision-making tables where policies about their lives are being made? Mm-hmm. We're in a deep learning process around that. And it's scary, but it's also really exciting because as we grapple with this, we see that so much more is possible. And we also know from historical experience that when we center the needs of the people who are most marginalized, everybody benefits. For example, affirmative action is commonly known to be a program that helps remove some of the barriers to college admissions and to job work for people of African-American descent. However, the biggest group of beneficiaries of affirmative action policies have been white women. Mm-hmm. When we center the needs of the people who are most impacted, we're all more likely to win.
Yeah, I love that. Absolutely. It's a similar goal, I think, that we share in terms of centering the stories that have not been heard or have not been listened to, have not been shared. And speaking to even going back to the first question Amy asked us around strategies that you use for that. And for me, writing is that strategy. That's how I find a lot of hope in my kind of contribution and what I can do for that change to take place and bring my talent to it, going back to this notion of we're part of a larger team and a larger collective. And it's not just one person, but this thought of what can we each do? And I think for the 15 of us that are here in this conversation together, that's something for us to think about as we even transition to some more of our questions from everyone. What is the role that we can each uniquely play? Because it can feel so large, it can feel so overwhelming. There are so many issues that we have yet to tackle when it comes to violence against women and the oppression of women and our girls. But to think about what is my unique gift that I can add to this team, or the many gifts that I can add, or the perspective that I can bring. So Janae, I would love to hear more about even your personal experience of how you got to this work and kind of what it was that you said, this is what I can bring to the table, to the team.
Thank you for that question. Well, I started off in this work probably long before I even knew that I wanted to be in this work or that I was in this work. I am a Black woman who was raised by my white mother in a white community. And so difference and othering have always been a part of my life, have always been a part of my search for understanding around how do we relate to each other as human beings? How do I, as a Black woman, step into the fullness of my Black womanhood without any examples of what that looks like around me? How do I learn about where I came from or who I want to be or who I can become? Those things were not pathways that were open to me by my community or by my family. So I went off in search of an education that would help me get there. And through the course of my education, studying anthropology and theater, I feel that my eyes were opened to all of these different kinds of human experiences. And I just truly fell in love with all of the different ways that human beings can express themselves. And then I started to think about, well, if this is the way that we can be together in community and we can express ourselves this way artistically, why don't we have laws and policies that reflect all of this greatness that we can become, that make it possible for us to step into this world that we can imagine for ourselves? So I went off to law school with stars in my eyes, like so many young people, thinking I'm going to change the world. And after I completed law school, I started working in a law firm and really wanted to do more, wanted to get closer to community. So I started working at Everyday Democracy and started traveling the country, working with regular everyday people who wanted to build community coalitions to work on the wicked problems that were plaguing their communities. Problems like economic insecurity, food insecurity, job insecurity, changing communities where communities were changing because new people were moving in, people with different backgrounds, communities that were shifting in demographics because immigrants were coming to live in community. Mm-hmm. And in the process of working with hundreds, thousands of people all across the country, I really started to get this much deeper understanding that we all want the same things. We all want safe places to live. We all want to be able to provide for our families. We all want to find meaning in our lives. We all want to be safe.
Yeah.
And what I was discovering more and more was that no matter how much personal will and excitement I was feeling from people in community around creating change at the grassroots level, we needed to have policy work that would meet those people's demands. If we're building community power to create change, there needs to be an outlet for that community power. We need to be able to inform policy. And that really led me to my work at Quelf and thinking about how do we start to craft policy that really reflects the needs of the people who have been systemically disenfranchised. I'm constantly inspired by Ayanna Pressley saying policy is my love language. Working on policy and bringing regular folks closer into that work so they have a deeper understanding of how the process works so they can effectuate change. That's the way I show my love for the people who are in my community.
I love that.
Yeah, thank you.
Are we transitioning to audience questions, Amy? I wasn't sure.
I would love to have audience involvement, but I want to be respectful of Janae. Do you have anything else you want to ask or layer in before we make that transition, or anything, Anna, you want to share?
It might be nice for both of us actually to speak about if we could say like three policies that we believe are what women need right now in our country. If we could make them reality tomorrow, what would they be? I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, Janae.
That's great. Oh,
absolutely. I'm so glad that we went there. I was hoping that would be an audience question. Well, first and foremost, we need universal healthcare. We need to be caring for the physical and mental well-being of our people. Too many people are one or two paychecks away due to overwhelming medical bills from utter financial ruin. If we really say that we are valuing the lives of people, then we need to make it possible for people to seek adequate, affordable healthcare when they need it. This is particularly true when we have rising rates of Black maternal mortality. This is an urgent issue. We also need universal childcare. If we say we want to be supporting women and working mothers and other working parents, then we need to be sure that we are providing, once again, safe, affordable, high-quality childcare. And frankly, the growing chasm between the rich and poor in this country is utterly reprehensible. It's morally reprehensible. We live in the richest country in the history of the world. There is no reason why we should have so many people, particularly children, living in poverty. And we know the number one thing that helps people get out of poverty is giving them money. Mm-hmm. We need a guaranteed basic income program in this country. And we really need to be thinking about it, especially from a justice and reparations orientation, and really thinking about people who have been systemically exploited, particularly Black people, descendants of enslaved people, and Native and Indigenous people. This country was built on our blood, sweat, and tears. And there is a debt that is owed. Also, there are lots of studies that show that when you give cash to mothers, their children are healthier. Their brain development is better. There are studies that prove this. So if we're really going to be talking about the ultimate policy, I think that can shift a lot of these intersectional issues, it would be guaranteed basic income.
I love it. You took some of mine, so I'll just add to it. They might not be my top three, but I'm going to add to it. For me, an important one is universal parental leave. That is not only a few weeks, but an actual amount of time that is more comparable to other nations that have the same resources that we do. There is no need for us to be going back to work within a couple of days for some people in the United States, or even weeks, that there should be time where that role is more supported, where there is space that this parent will still be paid to take time with their child and in that bonding and important bonding phase. So again, in terms of the amount of research that's done on so many of these things, this is really critical and something that we're missing out as a nation. I'd also say, so all of mine are probably going to be around motherhood since I think about it so much and write about it so much, but we also need to think about doulas and midwives being covered by insurance and that not being something only available to those who can afford it. As a Black feminist scholar, when I was expecting my firstborn, I was so aware of how dangerous it could be to be a Black mother and how biases were going to meet me at every turn. And that could be so overwhelming at times, that fear. But I was really privileged to be able to afford working with doulas and have them by my side when I was in the hospital, as well as with my daughter, who was born 5 months ago, having a midwife and was able to deliver her at home. And women of color who were with me, and studies show that this can reduce mortality for Black women and Black mothers. We know that even Serena Williams and Beyonce faced biases when they were delivering from this notion that Black women are stronger somehow and that they can withstand more pain. And so because of this perspective, when Black women say something's going wrong, I need help, it's very rare that they're actually heard and listened to and that action is taken in time to save their lives. So this is something that I hope is not only available for the privileged few who can afford it, but something that is covered, which would go along with this universal healthcare, but that we would also add these other medical experts that we quite often leave out of the equation. Guaranteed income, I completely agree with, an affordable quality child care. And I think ways that can even be made easier, especially when we're starting to go back to offices, is having daycare written into a company's kind of plan where their employees can go to the same exact place where they're going to drop off their children. It will even raise our levels of productivity for people to be able to say, okay, I'm coming to work and so is my child. So we just really need to do a lot more that speaks to the humanity of Americans, families, and strengthening those bonds. And I think we could see a really different world, especially for women of color.
I could not agree more. And I think you'll be happy to hear that here in Connecticut, beginning just this year, January 1st, we now have one of our country's strongest paid family medical leave programs, which provides up to 12 weeks paid leave for people to take care of themselves after they welcome a new child into a family or for a medical situation for themselves or to care for a loved one. I'm really excited to see the ways in which that starts to change the landscape of Connecticut and becoming a place that is much more dedicated to the well-being of our citizens. I had one more question to ask you, and I was just feeling so inspired by all of this. And this question's been percolating in my head this whole time. What I love so much about this, your book, The Three Mothers, is that it's not necessarily a retelling of history. Rather, it's the telling of untold stories of history that give us a much fuller perspective on what actually happened. And understanding our history helps us to make better choices about how we act and where we want to go in the future.
Right.
I'm wondering if you have an opinion on how we tell those stories of history, because of course, I was thinking, you know, three mothers, three women in your book, and my mind immediately went to Hamilton, thinking about the three Schuyler sisters. And there was a lot of creative license taken in the retelling of that history, reimagining that story through the eyes of people of color. And I'm wondering, as a historian, as an academic, as an author, how much of a value do you see when we have a more creative retelling of that history? It might not be 100% true, but it gets people excited to learn more. And I'm wondering, you know, how does that resonate with you as a person who, you know, meticulously researched, you know, every single fact for this book? And I'm sure you loved Hamilton as much as I did and understand the importance of it. But how do you view a work like that in comparison to your work?
Ooh, that is such a unique question. It's hard to say. I mean, I'll begin by saying that I am really invested in taking what I learned in the academy and the theory that can feel so large and complex and quite convoluted, and making it understandable and approachable and inclusive. So I knew when I started my PhD, I really wanted this to be my first book, whatever I studied for those several years. And I also knew that I wanted it to be published as a trade book, which means not published with an academic press. There's nothing wrong with academic press, but I wanted my book to be seen as something that anybody could pick up and be connected to, because I feel like so much can change in our country based off the stories we tell and how accessible those are, and people being able to speak to each other and connect and find people in history that they feel personally connected to as human beings versus it being told from this kind of detached perspective and observation, but instead as we are people. And I want you to get to know these women and kind of try your best to walk in their shoes as best as we possibly can, so that you now understand these moments in history from their perspective and how it hurt them, and how World War I and World War II were very different for a Black community member, that the Great Depression, all of these things that you might have thought you were quite familiar with, but maybe we're not considering the ways in which it impacted different people differently. So I am all for getting more people involved in conversations around race and gender and equity in all the many ways that are available to us. And I think what Lin-Manuel Miranda did was brilliant. I love, love, love Hamilton. There are definitely layers to it where I think that, you know, for instance, I really love to do more with The Three Mothers, turning it into a movie or turning it into a play. So there's conversations around that. And I'm excited to see what happens with that. And I would love if there's a Hamilton type musical, but that is actually about people who were actually of color in history, and that celebrates Black music and all the ways and all of the things that he accomplished so beautifully with Hamilton. But how much more powerful that could be if the people we were talking about really historically accurately were Black people themselves. I think that there are some things that come up with Hamilton that reduce the kind of violence of some of the the reality of the history that George Washington is not really someone that we all actually revere. He was a slaveholder. So it's kind of a weird conflicting feeling to feel like he's being showcased as the George Washington through Black music. And he's not actually somebody who we really celebrate in Black history. So there are definitely conflicting emotions that come up. But I would say in terms of the goal of bringing more people into conversation and kind of reaching out and saying, hey, you're welcome in this conversation as well. I think that's powerful. And with any work, any book, any TV show, any movie, there should be layers that we can critique and say, what is something we could have done better? How can we push this further? And that's how the world progresses. So I think that kind of back and forth conversation and would we change this or is there something else that you would do differently with this work and is important. And I don't think it robs from also the impact and the beauty of what was accomplished.
Well, I certainly felt the beauty and the impact of the three mothers. And the whole time I was reading it, I kept thinking, I wish a text like this had been available when I was a young Black woman learning about history, when I was a young Black mother thinking about what are the lessons that I want to impart to my children? What role can I play in raising them to become the kind of people who can help create the kind of world that we all deserve to live in? You had such vision in knowing that these were stories that needed to be told and the way that you told them. I do hope everyone gets a copy of this book and reads it. It's a compelling read. It's not a difficult read, which I found very refreshing for a book that is incredibly historically accurate. And it's just, the prose is so beautiful. Thank you for really shining a light on the stories of these women. It's making me want to go back through my history books and look up every man who's on the pages of those stories to find out who was his mother, what did she do, how were her lessons, now part of American history.
Thank you. That means the world. Thank you, Janae.
That's so great. And I think all of the things, I want to live in a world where these policies are in place for mothers and for communities. And I keep thinking about like the policies I keep reading about every day, which is let's pass laws that limit the way we teach history, right? Mm-hmm. This is the priority. how can that be the real social need? But I think they're all horribly wrapped together.
Yeah. That's why conversations like this are important. If we're going to be learning about real history, we're going to have moments of discomfort. And we need to be willing to sit in that discomfort. We need to be willing to have dialogue about it. And we need to be willing to also interrogate ourselves and think about, well, how did I learn what I believe to be true about the world? And what do I have to unlearn now that I've learned the truth about the world?
Beautiful.
Yeah, I love that.
So let me unpin our amazing, you guys are great conversationalists. You are, I love that we were able to give your voice space this evening, but also the voice of our community is here too. So I'm gonna unpin you, and we're a small enough group audience that we want you to just unmute yourself and ask a question. Hold on 1 second, a little technical. And maybe you want to put your screen on gallery view for best impact if you wish.
I am seeing that I'm only the only man here, and I have really enjoyed this tremendously. And without really thinking historically, the importance of a mother on these three heroes, it really hit home. So I thank the Beecher Stowe House and the conversation you two women had just touched me deeply. So all I can say is thank you.
Oh, thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you.
I know, isn't it kind of shocking that no one wrote this book before me?
Yes.
I think about that all the time. And I often say, you know, we just celebrated MLK Day and it's to celebrate his birthday. And we have this holiday because his wife advocated for us to celebrate his life. But we don't think about the other person who was in the room the day that he was born, as if he popped out of nowhere. So it's really great to celebrate alongside him on his birthday, the woman who birthed him. It seems like a really simple statement, but apparently one that has made a difference. So
I also was not I didn't realize that his Martin Luther King's mom was shot. I didn't do that. That's amazing, you know. Wow.
It's sad. Wild. And I mean, even a year after MLK was assassinated, her second son, Alberto's second son, also died under suspicious circumstances. He was found drowning in his pool, even though he was a good swimmer. So the family, the King family, had back-to-back-to-back awful tragedies, including the loss of Alberta.
Also the background of Mrs. Little, too.
It's shocking. I didn't even get into the most shocking parts of her story, so I hope you read the book, because there's a lot.
I want to say that I remember reading and hearing in history that one of the reasons they educated white women was so that they could educate their sons, mm-hmm. so their sons can go on to become leaders. And it's not that it takes away from not educating black women, but white women were starting to be educated so that they could educate men to go and rule the country, not because they wanted to educate women, mm-hmm. but to make better patriots. And I thought that was the oddest thing. I just was mad about that when I was a kid. But that was presented as one perspective by why women were given access to education, why white women were given access to education.
Yeah, I think that's even further argument for why, you know, what Janae was saying in terms of we need women to come together, because even the times where it seems like white women were going to have some advantage, it was always under some other, it was disguised by some other plan to still take away people's rights. So around the introduction of birth control, even Margaret Sanger then decides she's going to say, okay, well, you want black women to take birth control, don't you? So like, give us access so that we can. So there's always some other thing happening the further women are divided from each other. And there's more power, more that we can accomplish if we can be on each other's side.
Yeah, the white feminist movement. I mean, I have a daughter who is a women in gender studies major, and she had so many professors who were white feminists, and she just couldn't stand that because they weren't incorporating the full perspective. So taking the opinions of African-American women into perspective is relatively new.
Yeah.
Sadly. Yeah. there's not a lot of scholars out there doing the work that you're doing, Anna.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's long, long overdue.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So long overdue.
Yeah. And something actually, Danae, you mentioned this, and I would love to hear your thoughts and your experience with your mom. But my mom was also a white woman. And one of the biggest lessons she taught me was allyship. It was critical to her parenting of me, because she would often say, you know, I'm not going to pretend I know what it's like for you to be a black woman. I'm not going to say that you and I have the same experiences in life because we're both women. But she did say, I will walk by your side and I'll learn, and I will hear you, and I'll be here for you, and I will do my part in making this world a better place for you. And that I almost took for granted. I didn't realize that so many people had a hard time admitting these very simple truths. I don't necessarily know what it is to walk in your shoes as a black woman, but I believe that you deserve the same treatment as everybody else does. And I will walk beside you and I'll do my part. And that was, it was critical for me. And I think why I was able to build on everything she believed in, and then add my own experiences to that as well.
Mm. I love that you had that experience with your mother. I had a different experience, and not one that was born of any malicious intent on the part of my mother. A context I think that is important is that I grew up in poverty, and I do believe my mother was often in survival mode mm-hmm. around how to provide for us and how to keep us safe. And she did what she could. And I don't think it ever occurred to her to have that kind of a conversation with me, because of course she's my mother. You know, she loves me deeply. She thinks that the world should be my oyster. The world is ready to receive me when I'm ready to go out into the world. And I don't think that it was part of her understanding that I would have different experiences, particularly not being around other young women who looked like me. And it just wasn't something she thought about, because she didn't need to think about it as a white woman. And like I said, it wasn't anything that was born of an ill intent. But I do think that as I've gotten older, she's come to more of a realization around what that meant to be a white mother of Black children. And her eyes have been deeply, deeply opened.
Yeah. I feel like through those shared experiences, and then even in the ways that it contrasted, we're giving people examples of maybe even feeling seen, you know, someone saying, well, I didn't think I had to have that conversation. Now I realize it can go far, that can provide healing, but also that it's not too late for that to begin, that work to start, and that allyship. So wherever you are in terms of that spectrum, I don't know what everybody's identity is on this call, but I do hope that provides, you know, some from us sharing from our personal experience, the options for moving forward.
Yeah. And that also reminds me that it takes me back actually to a part of the conversation we had before about not being able to separate our womanhood from our Blackness, because they're so inexplicably intertwined. And I think one of the things that would really help in building, you know, the solidarity movement between women is for white women to talk about how whiteness has informed their sense of womanhood. And I think that is particularly true and powerful for white women who are parents of children of color.
Yeah.
It's a necessary examination that needs to be undertaken.
Absolutely.
I'll just jump in. Hi, I'm Leslie. Thank you guys. This was really precious. I love the two of you speaking with each other, but also Mr. Rahman, I think I'm saying his name right. That was like totally new information to me, like 31 recommendations from this bipartisan commission. Like, okay, what are we doing? And, you know, to think that you all spent all that time on it and came up with recommendations, and I do hope that gets filtered. But I loved, you know, you two women talking about hope in the beginning, because I really struggle. I'm 71 and waking up daily and trying not to go backwards and say, how did I not see this? How did I not see this? I'm like, stop it. Just you see it now. And what are you doing about it? You know, and just that balance between we have to accept some of this is the way it is, you know, but on the other hand, we don't want to accept too much and have too high expectations, and just constantly that kind of balance, which I think came through with you all talking. And, you know, beautiful to write a book. And I know, Janae, I've been following you since you became director of the group. I follow you all the time. I followed you when you ran for office before. And so I'm really excited, because I always felt that it was, you know, nothing against white women. I happen to be one, but I can see in a minute which groups, you know, act like they're diverse because they have a couple, you know, maybe women of color on their board. And we know that's just kind of, you know, a Band-Aid and not really for real. So I was glad when the organization picked you, somebody that's not afraid to say something too. That's the thing. I mean, you know, I know Habitat for Humanity said that she got a board that's half people of color, and she said to her board, I do not want somebody that's afraid to speak up to you guys, and you guys have to listen. It has to be equity. It can't just be, oh, aren't we good? We pick somebody that's a person of color. So you guys get that, of course. So anything I can do, you know, I'm all in, really, no matter like how much time I have left. I'm just like, this is just unacceptable that we're at this point and we just got to keep coming together, you know? So thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
Well, I want to respect everyone's evenings and our speakers' evenings. It's been a long business day for so many of us. So thank you for learning with us and contemplating these intense ideas. And let's all go to work.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. Be well, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for coming. Janae, you're marvelous. Great job, really.
Was that okay? Was that the conversation you wanted?
No, you were the equal that I knew that you could be. So that was beautiful from the policy side, right?
Oh, good. I'm glad.
It's not just history, it's actions and social justice. So
It is. I was a little surprised when she said, how did you get to where you were? And I was like, oh, I'm talking about myself.
I know. Well, thank you for sharing personally. Again, it expanded people's understandings and my own. So thank you.
And did I hear you say this is going to become a podcast?
Yeah. So on the Stowe Center website, there's on the sidebar, navigation bar, there's a button called Multimedia Gallery. And when you click in that, there are two little arrows on either side of the main screen, and you can step through all of the digital programming that we've been archiving. And you'll see the salons at Stowe where there are two podcasts in place. And then this one will get added probably next week for that full series.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And share it out with community.
I hope it was good.
It was beautiful.
Great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you for the invitation.
No, I look forward to our paths crossing in Hartford as we continue the work.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Have a good night.